You're listening to the More Time, More Profit podcast, the best place for entrepreneurs who are looking to grow past the startup phase of their business, but still need to learn how to free up more time to drive more profit. Now, present these real strategies, your successful business coaches and hosts, Adam John and Grant Muriel.
Welcome to More Time, More Profit, episode number 37. Today we're talking about the only keys you need to sell anything to anyone with James Shranko. My name is Adam John, and as always, I'm joined by Mr. Grant Muriel. What's going on, Grant?
Not much, buddy. I absolutely love this topic and this guy. So for everyone who's listening and wants to download the episode's framework and work through it with us, jump onto www.moretimemoreprofit.com/037.
Yeah, so today's topic is very important. Sales is a scary word for most people, especially if you haven't really been exposed to sales training. And if you don't have the right personality, it can be a little bit difficult. Back about 15 years ago, as a freelance web designer, I relied on referrals to get my business. Then I moved to a real sales-focused company, and I was exposed to Wolf of Wall Street-style cold calling. Then I started my own company and hired a gun sales manager to build out the team. Most back-end guys get super nervous when they think of sales, but like any skill, it can be learned. And let's be honest, there will be no business without sales. So today, I must say that with the popularity of sales funnels and correct marketing, the process can be a little bit less daunting. What about you, Grant? What are your experiences?
Yeah, too right. This is one of those topics that I love to hate. The reason why is that people always say that my personality matches being a salesperson. And I always took it as the biggest insult because it's really the reputation that salespeople have. However, I found my own way to really sell, which was through my reputation. And I'd aim to never let a client down and always put my personal reputation on the line to achieve greater sales. But then this was quite risky. When the business grew beyond me and it grew out of my control, I wasn't able to really confine my own personal reputation and make sure it was always delivered. So it also meant that I needed to start getting other salespeople in order to continually grow the business, right? Which was an impossible task to get them to meet to the expectations that I had, as well as the reputation and the audience and the network that I already had. But look, I managed to work it out back in the day, but I'm pumped, really actually pumped to hear what James puts in place in order to get other people to do his sales for him, but also how he does sales without really picking up the phone or touching base with too many people.
Beautiful. Yeah, mate, I can relate to that, so let's jump into it.
All right, so we've got James Shramko on the line, or as we all like to call him, the guru. Welcome, James.
Oh, gee, I don't think anyone who's got a specialty likes being called a guru, unless they're maybe teaching yoga or something. That's quite a fun introduction, though. How are you, guys?
Good, man. Well, you're the guru of surfing, in my opinion, so I'll still call you the guru. So James and I, we've known each other for about 2 years now. Yes, we're still in the honeymoon phase of our relationship. He's the founder of Superfast Business, and according to IMDb, he was also a sailor in Muriel's wedding.
A bit of an Australian movie reference there for our international audience.
He's someone who's always has a time to help other people. He's always got a heart of gold, and he just really wants to change the way that the business world is operating and see every single person succeed, which is really in line with what we try and do over here at More Time, More Profit. Although on the surface, he looks like an extremely laid-back individual with his daily surf sessions that he will never sacrifice, no matter how good you are. And I found that out as I was waiting for an hour in Manly. But he is a beast at sales. He's sold millions of dollars worth of tangible, intangible, and all other things in between. And I have to tell you that he's a fellow Australian that we really do look up to. So it's an absolute pleasure having him on. Now, to start off, James, how did you really get started, whether you were pulled in, directed to, or just gravitated towards sales originally? And what has made you keep up to maintaining your sales to now without just getting bored of it over the quite few years that you've had?
I think like some other people, I got into sales without even realizing that I was in sales. One of the first iterations was I was recruited by my grandfather to help him with his timber broking business, which he ran from the backyard of his house. And he would buy and sell timber on the telephone for a living for a 3% brokerage fee. And at that time, he was pretty much blind, but he could hear with supersonic radar. And he was teaching me about listening to the tone of the voice that these timber brokers, that these timber yards were using. And he'd also help me detect, you know, when the builders were looking for jobs, if they were sounding a bit desperate or, you know, he was sort of bringing subtleties into it. But I didn't really know that was anything to do with sales. I didn't even know what brokerage meant, if I'm being totally open about it. But My next job, you know, after this in an office was actually as a trainee account manager in a debt collection firm in the city of Sydney. And my job was to phone people up asking them to pay late payments. We'd been subcontracted by car yards and service centers and electrical stores to follow up their late overdue bills. And if we couldn't get the money, we had to sue these people with a statement of liquidated claim, which would often result in them going to court, getting a judgment against them and garnishing their wages. So I was pretty much selling an idea of them paying the bill to avoid all this hassle. So I was again in a sales role without really knowing that I was selling. And that progressed into a role where I was doing repossessions out in the field. So now I actually repossessed over 100 cars, and I had to do a lot of human communication here, a lot of emotional discussions. I had to protect myself from physical violence, threats of knives and guns and so forth, crowbars, as I'm dragging someone's car away on a tow truck. I had to negotiate pretty quickly on my feet. And finally, I went to a safe job in an administration role as a stock controller, seconded to a sales team, this crack sales team, to support a brand new technology company who'd come to Australia from the UK called Vodafone, and they were setting up digital telephony in about 1993. And I got exposed to all these amazing salespeople. I didn't know what sales really was. I thought they were pretty cool, and I know they got paid a lot more than I did. And some of them were a bit lazy too. They'd be out in the field, driving around or not, sleeping in, running along the beach, phoning in a couple of orders. And invariably, the customer looking for the salesperson would phone me in the office looking for them. And I actually, you know, having sat in on the meetings and started learning some of the material, which we'll probably talk about today, started having conversations with them. And it turned out I was starting to sell more than they were. And that wasn't even my job. And the human resources lady.
Did they at least give you commission?
No. I was actually earning $35,000 a year. I was working 8, 9, 10 hour days. And one of the salespeople ended up taking a spare room in my house. And I'd get the phone call through from my partner saying, hey, you know, he's not even awake yet. Well, now he's awake, but he's going down to the beach for a swim. Oh, now he's heading off to lunch. This guy, he seriously was earning $85,000 base salary plus a car allowance plus commission. And that's when I started to reconcile, hang on a minute, this sales gig, I've seen this guy and he's not that special. Maybe I could do that. And this HR lady at the company did a profile on me and she said, hey, we've done your DISC profile. And turns out you've got a perfect sales aptitude. And I said, really? And then I found out we're going to have a baby and the pressure was on to increase my income. And they wouldn't put me into sales because I was the only one who knew how to use this complicated Oracle software system that they'd established. So I had to apply for a job somewhere else. I actually went across the road to a Toyota dealership and applied for a sales job, and they rejected me. They gave the job to an experienced sales lady who'd been in a retail store, ladies' wear. And then I went down to BMW, and I probably did one of my best interviews ever and one of my last interviews, and got a job selling BMW. And that was my first official sales job. And I was about 23 years old. This is in the beginning of 1995. And Within a year of that, I was the number one BMW salesperson in the country. So there you go.
So your aha moment was when you were at work and this guy got up and went for a swim and you said, that's it. I know I need to do that. Whatever he's doing, I need to do that.
I've often used benchmarking as a tool to recalibrate myself. So there's been a lot of aha moments in my life, but it even happened to me, you know, years later from this. We're talking about, was it 10 years later, 2005 or so, even a little bit after that, about 2008 or 9. So quite some time later, I was in America having been to a conference for online marketing, but I was now the general manager of this Mercedes-Benz dealership. I switched to Mercedes-Benz, which is another story. And this guy, you know, I was making about $300,000 a year in my salary, which is a pretty good wage. You know, I had two company Mercedes-Benz, had a really good salary, and it was a pretty good job. However, This guy I was on the plane next to, who was going to the same conference, was making $100,000 a month. And then when we got to the conference, I met another guy who was doing about $100,000 a day.
100 grand a day. He's a baller.
He was one of the most successful CPA marketers on the planet, and probably a lot of listeners wouldn't even know what that means, but it just meant that he sold other people's stuff. He was good at driving traffic and selling stuff. So I came away from that trip thinking, I am playing way too small a game. And within 6 weeks, I was able to engineer a sale that allowed me to quit my job. And within the next year, I was making $1 million a year, and I've never looked back. And that was 10 years ago.
So it's safe to say that sales has now been bred into you, whether or not you're trying to get money as a debt collector or sell cars or even do what you're doing at the moment, which is ultimately selling intangible products. So there's actually three completely different things that you're selling. So looking at what we're about to cover off in the next 30 seconds, will every single person listening to this podcast be able to increase their sales conversion rate or even increase their ability to sell, irrelevant of their ability or type of business?
I would say so, because if you look back at the car dealership, we were actually selling cars, which is the obvious one, and parts. So they're physical things, but we're also selling time. That's what you're buying when you service a car, predominantly time. And we were selling money, which is what you're buying when you finance a car. So it works for tangibles and intangibles. And I think most people could be good at selling. There's a couple of people who are less good at it, of the four types of people that you generally find. And I could break that down if you like.
Yeah, just quickly run through that. That'll be interesting.
Very quickly. The worst type of salesperson is an expressive person who you would say is a typical salesperson. The wah, 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 chatty, chatty, chatty. You know, the compelling loudmouth.
Wah, wah, wah.
Right? They're not so good at selling. The other type of person that's not so good at selling is a very amiable, completely introverted, withdrawn person, because they've got their own little hang-ups, you know, about communication. The best types are the drivers, which is more your typical business owner, because they're pretty strong in their vision and they're persuasive. And then there's the analytical people, which is the people who can, you know, logically look at things and follow a process, like an airline pilot. If you could be an airline pilot, you probably have some analytical skills. You can follow a checklist and go through the same process, because ultimately sales is just a process.
I agree with that. I love it. Look, awesome, mate. Enough chit-chat. Let's jump into the meat of the episode.
And if you want to ask James or ask any questions, jump on the Facebook and search for More Time, More Profit group and ask away. So, James, before this podcast started, I had this burning question, but I think I know the answer to it already. It was probably the most important question I was going to ask you all day. And is it true that you book your meetings based around how good the surf is?
It's true.
And it's not booked early in the morning when the swell is good, I'm sure.
No, what I do is I only take calls on Wednesdays, and I have a block in the morning and a block in the afternoon, so I can either go before or after each block. So I've got three windows of opportunity, which caters for a moving tide.
I thought that was going to be the case.
Adam's the same around. He's a kite surfer, so he's very similar. I struggle to get hold of him when the wind's up.
It's the only way to live. So today we're talking about the only keys you need to sell anything to anyone. So James, what's the framework, the processes or steps at a very high level that allowed you to get the results in your career?
I think the first fundamental step is just to think about what selling actually is, because I would say most people don't know what it is and they're very scared of it and they have a negative connotation with it. Is it worth defining it?
Let's do it.
So let's talk about marketing and selling, because these things come up a lot. Marketing is just letting people know you exist. That's it. So that has a lot of implications. Selling is like, okay, they know you exist. Selling is just a process of change from one situation to a better alternative situation. That's it. And that guiding idea, which I think I picked up from Spin Selling by Neil Rackham, changed the way I look at selling. I'm simply helping people be better off. And why wouldn't you feel good about that?
So it's really just a process of changing someone from their current situation, whether it's good or bad. And trying to get them to a better endpoint.
Exactly. People will not buy unless they think they'll be better off, unless you cajole, force, manipulate, or hold them to some duress, which is, a fair bit of that goes on with what you hear about high-pressure selling, boiler rooms, manipulative tactics. that's where people are being forced to buy. That doesn't really fit the definition because they're not going to be better off. So true selling is ultimately when the customer makes the decision to buy. That's the best scenario we can hope for. We don't have to force someone to think a certain way. We just set up the environment that lets them see it for themselves.
I love that. I reckon that's so true. When people focus too much on the features and what they're actually selling as opposed to taking them through a journey. And I would completely agree with that.
Well, the problem with a lot of salespeople, Grant, is that they're making a sale to be better off themselves. But it's not about you if you're the salesperson. It's about your prospect, your customer. That's the only person who matters in the equation if you have integrity.
Yeah, well put. I think it's so important that you put the focus on the right party. You know, it's not about me as a sales guy. It's about the customer and the problem that you're trying to solve. So, James, what is the actual framework?
Well, I learned a framework from these superstar salespeople, which was very effective for me from then on, and I still refer to now. I think it's great, and it's spin selling, and it's just a four-part acronym, S standing for situation. Where's someone at? You know, you've got to know where they're at if you're going to help them, and importantly, they should know where they're at. So if they could be honest about that, that helps too. P is problem. What is the problem they're having? What challenge are they having? Once you've identified that, I is for implications. What's the implication of that problem? What does having that problem mean for this person? And then N is needs. What do they need? Like, what's the solution? And it's a very simple framework, but you can use this framework in so many different environments. And like, I could talk you through an example of you pulling into a fuel stop to buy some fuel, or whether you're buying a photocopier. The exact same process is happening, but it might happen at different speeds. But this formula is most specifically developed for high solutions, like high value solutions. So it's been more applicable to the markets that I'm in.
So walking through this example of a photocopier, so the situation, what would that be? And then what would the problem and the implication, the need be?
Okay, situation, I'm a law firm and I've got a photocopier that it's doing an okay job, but it's starting to splotch the papers. So that's now leading into the problem. The problem is the splotchy papers are coming out every now and then, and it's starting to cost more to maintain this machine. The implications, you know, and this is where it gets fun, and this is really the step that's missed by most other frameworks. When, you know, the other framework of problem, agitate, solution, you know, agitate's supposed to cover this one. But the implications are, wait, what if I've got a high profile client and they can't read the paper? Or, hey, we're in the courtroom putting a case to trial and we can't read the print. Or our maintenance costs are astronomical and we're not actually even making a profit when we charge the customer a dollar per page or whatever, but we're actually losing money when we photocopy. So then it leads to the solution. Well, even the customer can see here, it's probably time to just get a new photocopier. And then you could jump in with some of the reasons why that's going to be good for them. They're going to pay a lot less for maintenance. They'll never have to worry about it being splotched, you know, not for the next 5 or 10 years or whatever. They can turn up to court in confidence that all the papers are clear and legible. They're really giving their clients better value for money when they're charging for photocopier. They're getting something good and they're still making a profit on the thing because of the fantastic financing options available in this photocopier machine.
I think looking through the framework, is there any need to talk to objection handling or anything like that? Or do you just continually go back to their problems?
No. Most objections are raised by the salesperson. There's these huge myths in the sales industry that you need to handle objections, that you need 17 tricky closes, you know, porcupine closes and tie downs and all this stuff. Doesn't matter if you have a spin framework and you work on better questions in the investigation phase. Usually the customer will do the buying and they'll be asking for the order, not the salesperson.
So if you take it back to when you were selling lumber, right? So you're selling wood. The situation is that I'm building a house and I need some wood. The problem is that I currently don't have the wood, or I don't like my current supplier because of the quality. Then you obviously understand my implications means that I can't finish my project on time. So the need is that I have to get some more wood. When you come up against a competing timber yard or someone else, right, how do you apply spin selling so they purchase your stuff? Is it that you always push for them to make the close on the first call? Is it that you, I don't know, just try and outline to them more about their problem? or more about the implications that they've got? Because obviously you've got a lot of factors that come into play, such as price, objection handling from the other side, or even questions that the other side give to the customer to go and ask you. How do you just bring them back to the spin selling process?
Right, so the customer's always going to think that it's about price. They'll try and make that the situation, but it's never about price. That's like probably the fifth thing on their criteria. You definitely hope to discover the customer's situation in more depth than your competitor, because when you unlock that, it will give you a window into the kind of implications that could really be costly or expensive or awkward for them. You might find out that they have a deadline, which if they miss, they'll have to pay a penalty fee on the building. You might find out that it has to pass a certain fireproof grading that the competitor who's offering a quote hasn't actually factored into their quote. You might find out that they don't need it for another month, so you could actually buy it cheaper if it's not going to be there in such a hurry, but you thought that maybe you needed it instantly if you didn't ask the question. So doing a better job of investigation would really help. And I've seen examples about this. So one that comes to mind is an elderly couple who were looking at a Mercedes-Benz from me, and they were comparing it to a Jaguar. And through my investigation process, I'd found out that the main use for their vehicle is to pick their grandkids up from school. So I was able to point out to them that the Mercedes-Benz had a higher safety rating. And for them, that was more compelling than any amount. There's no dollar value you would put on the safety of your grandkids. So they were swayed towards that solution because it made sense to them when I was able to throw a spotlight on that particular point.
I love that example around the elderly couple buying a Mercedes. So what was their problem? It was they just needed a new car? Couldn't they have just got a lower class car? Or how did you say that they needed a Mercedes?
Because the thing about cars is they start to age. You know, from when you drive them out of the driveway, they start doing their creaking, and they don't smell like a new car anymore. And you know, they get old. They start costing more in maintenance. There's a lot of fear around the end of warranty period. When the warranty runs out and something breaks, it's very expensive on a luxury vehicle to repair. Is certainly the big fear in the customer's mind. And also, they're losing a little bit of status down at the golf club. And also, technology improves. You know, trickle down technology from the good brands makes its way into regular cars years and years later. So the good brands are getting the airbags first, and they're getting the braking sensors first, and they're getting the auto headlight dipping things first. And that's why when it comes down to a car, there might be a number of areas you could probe to find out what's more important. But we actually had an acronym called SPACED, and it would help us start to segment, you know, which area is more interesting for this customer. Is it safety? Is it performance? Is it appearance? Is it comfort? Is it economy? Is it durability? And from there, we could narrow it down. And anything you talk about that's really hitting that customer's actual problem is relevant to them and more compelling for them to solve, especially when they can see this situation clearly.
So the problem is they just want a quality car that always smells like a new car. And the implications, if they don't get a Mercedes, as an example, is they're going to be down at the service yard a lot more, and they're never going to have that new car smell like you would for getting a Mercedes or something like that. Is that correct?
For these people, the problem was that they're transporting their grandkids in an unsafe vehicle, and they want the newest, most safe vehicle on the road, because in the unfortunate situation of them being involved in an accident, there's no way they could go to their own children and explain something happened to their grandkids. Like that would be just a terrible thing to have to do. So that was a compelling driver for these people.
Yeah, love that.
Yeah, I do too. Now, listen, I want to shift the focus a little bit. Once had a CEO say to me, we're a sales company. We're actually a marketing company at the time, but if sales driven, is this true? Are all companies predominantly sales companies, or should the CEO be completely sales driven? What's your take on that one, James?
Well, fitting with my definition of selling, if you're helping people be better off, then I suppose that's okay for a company to be doing that. I would hope that most companies are in business to, you know, improve the lives of their customers.
Right. I suppose you get two sides of the fence.
You'd hope, right?
Yeah, you'd probably get like a Zuckerberg, who's probably more of a technical type of guy, who's a CEO. But then my old CEO, they were all just sales guys, so they didn't really care if they sold marketing or pink pogo sticks. That was their sole focus. So I just found that fascinating, and that's why I just wanted to run that past you.
Well, I think Zuckerberg fits more closely with the true definition of selling. I think he's looking to empower the lives of people and connect, have free internet for developing nations and this sort of stuff. So, you know, he's very product driven because he wants the product to help people. And the guy who's selling pink pogo sticks or whatever, people, if someone buys a pink pogo stick, I suppose they feel they're going to have more fun than before they had a pogo stick. So if you sell ethically, you know, with integrity, there's still going to be a market for a lot of things. But I think there's a special place reserved in hell for people who sell dodgy products that don't improve the lives of others, you know, that are dangerous or that are purely set up to enrich the owners. And I'm sure there's some sinister corporations who do that, and hopefully they don't succeed for too long. You know, and I think in this world with social media, at least there's a little bit more accountability for people who push bad products. There's a little bit more recourse in some cases. So that's probably one change I've seen in the last 20 years.
I love it. So today we talked about the framework of sales, and we know that it's really a core skill to have in business. And we understand that life's a sale. We sell ideas to our partners. Kids sell the idea of getting an ice cream to their parents. For anyone in business out there listening today who is a bit apprehensive or nervous about starting selling, what advice do you have for them?
Just start today. Just think about the framework. Like, apply it to every situation. As you pull into the fuel stop to buy fuel, just think about, okay, what's my situation? I've got an empty tank. The problem? It's not going to fill up by itself. Implication? Well, I'm going to run out of fuel somewhere on the road. I have to push my car off to the side, get somewhere and buy a jerry can, and then come back to the car at the whole time, you know, risking my personal safety. So what do I need? I need some fuel, and I'm going to buy it now. You know, sold, sign me up. And it's happening all the time. Just be conscious of it and then play with it a little bit. The temptation, which I think is really pointed out in the Spin Selling book, is to move quickly from problem to solution. The money really is in developing the implications. That's the extra step that gets you the bonus rewards.
Yeah, so I love the one thing in Spin Selling is that what you just touched on, which is the closing or the call to action or anything like that. So when I run through your situations, outline the problems that those situations create, the implications on your life, etc., that has. And then I talk to the need. So you need to buy a Mercedes. Do you put the call to action in the need? So you have scarcity and everything.
Yeah. You could be consultative. You could say, look, based on what you've said, Mr. Customer, this is the solution that I would recommend, you know, and that's an easy way to sort of move forward. In the book, they talk about that you're just looking for a progression. You know, in sales, you're either stalling or you're moving forward. So what you're looking for is what's the most useful or likely outcome we could hope for in this situation. So in the case of, I guess, back to cars, if someone's on the telephone, really what you're hoping to achieve there is to make an appointment with someone so that they could drive a vehicle, because generally they're not going to buy it unless they drive it, for example. So we're not trying to sell the car on the phone. That's an unrealistic expectation. So if we start heaping pressure on and pushing too hard on selling the actual car, we're going to get caught in a really dodgy place of price discounting and so forth. If we just sell the appointment, if we were actually focused on the customer being able to improve their situation, we would like to find the right car for them. To find the right car, we probably want them to drive one or two of them to see which one's a good fit, to see if it really does solve their problem. Then they'll be placed in a better position to make a decision to move forward. And then we're actually helping them. So if you're always thinking, what's going to be the most helpful for this customer? And sometimes to help a customer, it's about not letting them off the hook, you know, from making a decision that could make them be in a better position. Sometimes we have to help them. So, you know, that's probably deeper level stuff, but we shouldn't let people off the hook either. And they say somewhere there's research that says 50% of salespeople just don't even ask for the order because they're too shy or they're worried about rejection. But if you're thinking about it from the point of view of, hey, I could help this person if I just suggest a solution here, or I'm, you know, it could be simple saying, hey, would you like some help with that? If you're a service consultant, you'd say, hey, here's a plan we've mapped out for your business based on the problems you're having and what could happen if you don't do something. You know, this is the solution we recommend. That's actually the word solution. Would you like some help implementing this? And they might say, yes, great. Well, let's get started. And then you move into the agreement or the paperwork or the heaven forbid contract.
I guess one of the final questions that I have to ask is, we all don't convert at 100%. So is there a secret strategy or a secret sauce that you do with the lost leads that you get? So someone comes through, you do your situation, problem, implication, needs, or you spin selling, and then they don't purchase. What do you do with them then? Obviously, you don't just burn them and get rid of them and say, I don't like this person. How do you go through and re-engage with them?
Well, obviously, you want to filter very well so that you're trying to only speak with the right person. So in the case of my speaking to someone for a call, I will frame that as a decision-making call. And to get to that call, we will have already had some pre-dialogue. So I want to minimize the waste. In that scenario, you will get a conversion rate of 80 or 90%. Tight filtering gives you less runoff. If you do have runoff, then I would look at some way you could recycle that. So can you pass it on to someone who can help? You might do that for goodwill. You might do it for a fee. Could you downsell a product that's more appropriate, a better solution for this customer at this time? Maybe just put them on a news program that over time, when their situation changes, allows them to be able to come back and do business with you because you didn't burn them or take out your frustration on them and turn your problem into their problem.
All right. So I guess what I want to do is I want to run through a little bit of the framework that you've shared with us. So correct me if I've missed any of these points. So it's a bit of a foundation and a preface. Everyone needs to think about what selling actually is. The difference between marketing, which is letting people know that you exist. Sales is really the process of change from a particular situation to a better endpoint or a better situation. And this basically outlines what the customer needs before they say yes. So we're always getting them to where they want to be. And the best way for any business relevant of what you're selling to implement this, coming straight from the dragon's mouth, we've got the spin selling technique, which is also a book written by Neil Rackman, which is step one, the situation. So where is the customer at currently? So it's never about the price. They're always in a situation of need. We also need to spend a bit of time really asking them about what their situation is. So we can do this through exploration calls, investigation calls, etc. Because when we understand where they are, we can start providing their needs based on the problems that they outline. And just a suggestion, I believe that people should always put this in order of importance. So going to your reference before, James, having the security and safety around a Mercedes-Benz for the grandchildren is a lot higher than obviously a performance for those individuals, but it would be different for somebody else. Second one is a problem. So what do they need resolved? And we go and populate this with the situation that we've shared with the customer. So when we've finished up our exploration and our investigation call, we can go and populate our problems that we know they have. Third part is to understand the implications that come from these problems. So these are the external situations that our potential customers are having due to these problems, such as currently my grandkids are not getting to school safely enough, which has an implication because it's increasing stress in my life. It's increasing worry. I don't know what I'm going to do if that happens. So then we can start talking about the implications, which is more of the external to the problem. And the fourth is the need or the solution. So what do they need that you can provide in order to solve these implications and problems? And this is really where you go and do your closing, or you actually ask for the order. Now, I think the best key takeaway that we took away from this as well is if someone comes through and doesn't say yes to our need or our solution, you loop it straight back to the situation and work straight through it. So if they don't sit there saying yes, it means that you haven't understood the situation appropriately, or you've missed a key problem or an implication that's actually true to their heart. So you loop it back and keep bringing them around until they say yes to that point. How'd I go with that one, James?
Very good. That's an excellent summary. I'll just add two distinctions there. There may not be a problem with your process. It could just be a condition they have. For example, you might have done everything perfectly except the person in your showroom is visiting from another country for 2 days and they have absolutely no desire or capacity to purchase something in your country. You've probably been in that situation in a duty-free store in another country where you might have looked at something, but you're not really going to buy it. And
that was me last week.
All right. And then there's another thing where we might be thinking, well, how do we find out what their problems are? We might just go for the jugular, you know. So what's your problem? There are much better ways, more sophisticated ways to ask that. And one great way, and plastic surgeons would use something like this. It might be, what would you like to change? You know, so once you find out the situation, I might say, hey, tell me what you're driving now. And they might say, well, I've got this Mazda hatchback. And I might say, what do you like about it? See, this is a nice way to compliment them, not, oh my goodness. And then I might say, what would you like to change about it? And they might say, well, you know, I'm just ready to to celebrate my business success. I'm really looking for something I can take the roof off, you know, a roadster. And they're just giving you clues, and you can work off that. So there's just a couple of distinctions, but excellent summary.
Fantastic. And to download all the amazing examples, the Broom Framework and wrap-up points of this episode, go to www.moretimemoreprofit.com/037 for episode 37.
That's right. Don't forget to download all the points so that you can print off the worksheet and run through them yourself.
James, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on today, and we appreciate all your insights. Can you tell us where we can go find out a little bit more about you from website, social media, something you wish to promote?
I would start at superfastbusiness.com, and thank you so much for having me.
Awesome. We'll put that link in the show notes for everyone. We'll be continuing this conversation over at Facebook. Go to Facebook and search for More Time, More Profit Group and join in the conversation with us there.
Thanks, everyone. Don't forget to jump onto iTunes, click subscribe, look at our podcast, and leave us a review of exactly what you've got from this episode.
That's it from us. We'll catch you the same bat time, same bat channel next week. It's bye for now.
Catch you later, guys.
You've just been listening to More Time, More Profit Podcast. For more info, check out moretimemoreprofit.com. Make sure to tune in at the same time next week for another dose of real-life business strategies.